Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and our YouTube channel. I'm Mark Zitter, chair of the Zetima Project, CEO of Zitter Health Insights, and a member of the club's Health and Medicine member-led forum. I'm also chair of the club's series on end-of-life issues, of which today's program is a part. It's both surprising and distressing that today in America, many people die in ways they say they don't want, suffering and tethered to machines. One day, when Dr. Angela Velandes had trouble explaining to a dying patient the possible consequences of her treatment options, he decided to walk her down to the intensive care unit. She immediately understood where her decision might lead, and it changed her outlook. This caused the proverbial light switch, the light bulb to switch on, and led Dr. Velandes to co-found Advanced Care Planning Decisions, a not-for-profit foundation with an unusual approach to improving healthcare quality. The organization has created dozens of powerful videos to support advanced care planning and to facilitate difficult conversations about end-of-life care. Dr. Velandes's approach, which he's applied to large healthcare systems and even entire states, has helped thousands of clinicians, patients, and families have the conversation. He's written a book by that title, The Conversation, A Revolutionary Plan for End-of-Life Care. Today we'll hear excerpts from that book and we'll also see parts of several videos. Our radio and podcast audiences will be able to access these video clips online as well. Dr. Velandes is a faculty member at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, and he's also a faculty member at Harvard Medical School. His research, and much of his research, involves the videos themselves to demonstrate their effectiveness. His research is supported by the National Institutes for Health, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, the Alzheimer's Association, and the Informed Medical Decision Foundation. Dr. Velandes is a graduate of Harvard College, Yale Medical School, and the Harvard School of Public Health. Please join me in giving a warm Commonwealth Club welcome to Dr. Angela Velandes.
Thank you, Mark. Good evening.
Good evening. Come on. It's wonderful to be here, and thank you for coming. I realize many of you have had a long day at work, so I really appreciate you taking time out to talk about this. It's great to see so many friends. Candace from when I was growing up in New York City, Dr. Lenny Lopez, Dr. Amy Garland, Dr. Jessica Zitter, who has her... Oh, is that not on? It's not good enough. Really great to see so many friends out here tonight. So let's start with the good news. The good news is, that's better. The good news is, it's a great time to have a serious illness. It's true. It's a wonderful time to have advanced cancer. Today, I routinely give immunotherapy, the body's ability to harness its own immune system to fight off cancer. Lenny and Amy and I were reading about that in research when we were resident and med students over a decade ago, and it is something that we do now routinely. That's incredible. For many advanced cancers, we are able to do tailored genetic therapies. Tailored genetic therapies. That's the stuff of Star Trek. Seriously. It is an amazing time to have an advanced illness today. If you chose today to live in the history of Western healthcare, you hit the jackpot. You really did. But if you're a patient with a serious illness today, you have probably picked the worst time in American healthcare to get sick. I spend more time looking at my computer screen than I do at the face of the patient in front of me. I spend more time, and I know my patient's laboratory values far better than I do the person in front of me. So although it is the best of times in terms of healthcare, it is also the worst of times. And all of us are of an age where we've had a grandparent, a parent, perhaps a spouse, or perhaps you too have had a serious illness. And for some of us, even a child who's had a serious illness. And as we go through our own journey this evening, I want you to think back to that time when you bore witness to their journey, when you walked to that doctor's office with them. And I want you to remember that time because you remember that that doctor never asked them what was important to them and how they wanted to live whatever time they had left on this earth. So remember, at the end of the day, all of us are going to end up on the other end of that stethoscope. So when we ask most Americans, where do they want to die? Where do they tell us? Home. In that most prestigious medical journal that I still have not gotten published in, Consumer Reports, in one of their last surveys, over 90% of Americans want to die at home. They don't want to die in a hospital. And yet, what are the facts? Where do most Americans die today? Hospitals or healthcare facilities. If you're over the age of 65, fully two-thirds of Americans are going to end up dying in a hospital, in an ICU, often with a tube shoved down their throats, and often in a good deal of pain. That misalignment between the type of medical care people want and the type of medical care they end up getting is what I consider the most urgent problem in American healthcare. Now, you've all been reading about it every other day on the front page of the LA Times, the New York Times. There's another story about care at the end of life. It's the hot new topic. Unfortunately, the prism through which it is often portrayed is through the prism of cost. And I ain't gonna lie to you, end-of-life care in America is extremely expensive. But you know, as a doc who's in the trenches, I'm concerned about cost, but I'm concerned about something else even more. I'm concerned that a lot of the things that we doctors, do to our grandparents, our parents, and our loved ones, is simply unwanted care. If we know that most people don't want to die in a hospital with a tube shoved down their throat, and yet most people are still dying like that, that is unwanted care. And you know what? It's happening routinely hundreds of thousands of times across this country. And let's start calling it for what it is. It's not just unwanted care. It's a medical error. In fact, it's the definition of a medical error. If you walk into a hospital and you end up getting something that you never bargained for, that is a definition of a medical error. It is no different than a surgeon who has amputated a body limb on the wrong side of the body. It's no different. It's no different than an ICU doctor who has not followed some checklist. When we end up getting something in our healthcare system that we never bargained for at the end of life, it's a medical error. You know what the crazy thing is? I still get paid for that care. I still get paid for doing things upon people's bodies that they never wanted at the end of life. Now, why is it that the most sophisticated healthcare system in the history of American healthcare is able to give immunotherapy, is able to do tailored genetic therapy, but when it comes to end-of-life care, it gets it so wrong? Well, I think the main reason is that many doctors, perhaps most doctors, were never trained to have the conversation. Look, I took 4 years of medical school, 3 years of residency, 3 fellowships in 4 years. In order to be called doctor, I had to show competency in performing 10 episodes of CPR, 3 lumbar punctures, 2 central lines, 5 intubations and 2 paracenteses in order to get that MD. But never did a senior physician have to certify that I could actually talk to a patient. That's the reality. That's the crazy healthcare system that we live in today. But you know, sometimes words might not be enough. Sometimes we need images or videos to help all of us know what are the questions that I need to know when I have an advanced serious illness. What are my options for medical care when I do have advanced heart failure or advanced cancer? And so that's what I do. I try to create short films to help patients and families empower themselves. What we're trying to do is to flip that power dynamic, because here's the reality. Today, oh, by the way, you know we're all going to die, right? All right, just making sure. Part of living means dying. And so we're all going to die. And so life's final chapter needs to be written at some point. The problem is today, I'm the author of that final chapter, your doctor. You are not the author. What we are trying to do is to flip that paradigm so that people are empowered to know the questions they need to ask and to know their options for medical care. So that's where we're going to go. And I'll talk for about a half hour, and then we're going to take some questions. But to get us going, like Jessica Zitter knows, I love stories. So I'm going to start with a story. I want you to meet Helen Thomson. Helen Thomson was one of this country's foremost literary critics on the poetry of Walt Whitman. By a show of hands, how many of you are familiar with the poetry of Walt Whitman? All right, this is a biased audience, Commonwealth Club. Oh my gosh. You laugh, but when I ask my medical students and residents that question, often a single or no hand goes up. Walt Whitman didn't make it to the core curriculum. Well, Helen Thomson and I hit it off because we could both recite the opening lines of Whitman's magnum opus, The Leaves of Grass. You see, I was born and bred in Brooklyn, New York, where Whitman spent the first half of his life. So every other street corner had a Whitman elementary school, and all the pupils were forced to memorize the opening lines. I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. Now, you may be asking yourself why I'm telling you about Helen Thomson or the poetry of Walt Whitman. What I haven't told you is that Helen Thomson was my patient just a few years ago. What I haven't told you is that Helen Thomson was an older female with widely metastatic cancer admitted to my hospital. What I haven't told you is that Helen Thomson was dying. And so on that day that I admitted her, I did a history, I did a physical, and then I got to that part in the conversation that all providers, all clinicians get a little bit uncomfortable with, and that's when the words of Whitman metamorphosed into other words. Words like goals of care, CPR, breathing machines, comfort care. And so I looked at the professor and I said, "Professor, you have seen scores of doctors before ever laying eyes on me. Oncologists, pulmonologists, primary care doctors, surely someone has started the conversation with you." And she gave me that blank stare that I think so often patients give us, because no one takes the time to start that conversation. And so what could I do? I started my conversation with her. I said, "Professor, I think it's important that we have a forest from the trees perspective. I think we need to know the risks and benefits of all these interventions, but I need to know where you are on your journey with this illness." And that's when she continued to give me that blank stare. And that's when I naively asked her, I said, "Professor, would you mind taking a walk with me to the intensive care unit so I can actually show you some of these things?" Of course, she obliged. We didn't walk to the ICU. I put her in a wheelchair, rolled her down to the intensive care unit, got to show her a breathing machine, got to show her a patient on the breathing machine. And what the professor was able to do was to get a sense of the place, to hear the beeps and buzzes, see the colorful monitors, feel the rhythm of the intensive care unit. Now, as fate would have it, I obviously didn't plan on this, but there was a code blue in the ICU, and that's when I immediately whisked the professor out of the intensive care unit, but not before she caught a few glimpses of CPR. When we went back to her room, she looked at me, and she said, "Words, words, words. Angelo, I understood every single word that you said before. Goals of care, CPR, comfort care. I am, after all, a professor of English. But I had no idea that's what you were talking about. Doesn't look like that on television." And that's when it occurred to me, at a young professional age, that so often in healthcare, doctors try to have the conversation, but patients, and more often than not, families, are thinking about the latest episode of ER, Grey's Anatomy, Saint Elsewhere for another generation, where CPR is successful in every patient in the hospital, where the miracle cure for your cancer is right around the corner, and where everybody looks like George Clooney on Event. Notice alert, the reality is very different. So what I began doing was taking all of my patients and their loved ones on their own personal tour of our hospital. Some patients and families I brought to our intensive care unit. Other patients and families I brought to our dialysis unit. And what every single person told me was that this was the most powerful and empowering experience that they had ever had, that they couldn't imagine making a decision about care at the end of life without my tour. Now, the nurses, who are the smartest people in the hospital, loved what I was doing. They quickly saw the educational value in what I was doing, but they also quickly put an end to my tour business because they knew I was breaking patient confidentiality. And so here's the conundrum that I was left with. How could I recreate this powerful and empowering experience to help patients and families understand what are the questions they need to think about and what are their options for medical care? And that's when a group of us came up with the idea of creating short films to help empower patients and families so that they can navigate this crazy healthcare system that we have created with the healthy patient in mind, not the patient with a serious illness. So that's what I do. It's not just me, it's a group of 100 of us. And what we do is we not only create these videos to help you, patients and families, know these questions and to understand your options, but we actually study them. I should make a note, during med school, I took some time off to go to film school, so it was natural to meld both my medical interest and film interest, if you were wondering. It wasn't a coinkidink. But what my research group does is we not only create these films, because you know what happens in medicine? Some things sound good in theory, but in practice, either don't do anything, or worse yet, have adverse events. Just think of postmenopausal HRT, hormone replacement therapy. Sounded like a good idea, but when we did the study, not too good of idea. It actually hurt more people than it helped. And so what our group does is we actually study to see what would happen if instead of me, the doctor, being the author of your life's final chapter, you're in the driver's seat. What if patients could make these decisions because they were empowered? And so I'm going to do something very unusual. I'm going to make you all clinical epidemiologists. I'm going to show you one study to see what's possible if people are in the driver's seat. And it's in the context of cancer. How would a video of the goals of care have helped me have that conversation with Professor Helen Thompson to talk about things like CPR? And what I hope that small study does for you is to help you imagine an alternate universe where the future is not doctors writing your life's final chapter, but patients and families being the authors of their own life's final chapter. So here's the study. We took 50 patients, all with advanced cancer, from my hospital, Massachusetts General Hospital. These were all patients who had just a few months left to live. And what we did is we randomized or split the group into two groups. Half of the group had a verbal discussion about what sort of medical care they wanted now that they had advanced terminal cancer. The other half had the same conversation, and then they saw a short video that reviewed with them what are the questions you need to ask and what are your options for medical care. And the question that we had was, did they make different decisions? So here are the decisions that all of us have when we step foot into any hospital in America. These are your three options: life prolonging care, limited care, and comfort care. And just so that we're all on the same page, with life prolonging care, here's the patient telling me, Dr. Angelo, I want to live as long as possible. I want as many, many days as possible. I don't care about the quality. The middle category, limited care, is the patient telling me, hey, Dr. Angelo, do whatever you can, but nothing too aggressive. You know, bring me to the hospital, but none of that crazy stuff, CPR. And the third option, comfort care, here's the patient telling me, Angelo, I want to live as well as I can for as long as I can, but I want each day to be a good day. So those are the three options that everybody in America has, and those are the three options in our study. But for the group that was randomized to the video, they got to see visual images of what each of those categories of care look like. So I'm going to show you a sample, one of our videos, which is actually on YouTube. So I hope after this event you go home and watch it and perhaps have a discussion with your loved ones, with your partners, with your kids, and eventually with your doctors. It's on YouTube, and it's at theconversationbook.org for our podcast listeners, theconversationbook.org. And all of our videos are pretty short. This one's about 5 minutes long. And what we try to do is not steer people one way or the other. That's not my job as a doctor. My job as a doctor is to help you make a decision that makes sense for you based on your life that's authentic to what you believe in. And my job is to help us both come to an understanding. Now, before I show you the video and just make sure that volume is loud enough, here's what I want you to think about. Remember that time that you went to the doctor's office, when you went with your mom, with your grandma, with your kid, when they had a serious illness. And I want you to think back to that time that that doctor did not ask your loved one what was important to them. And I want you to think about an alternate universe, a different future, where all of us know the questions we need to ask and know our options, because we would have watched a video before ever seeing the doctor. Talking about medical care at the end of life can sometimes be difficult, but it doesn't have to be a sad conversation. There's a common three-step approach to do it well. The three steps are: start the process and have the conversation. Talk to your loved ones about your values and what's important to you. And then talk to your healthcare team about your medical choices. Let's review each one of these steps so you can make sure you get the right care at the right time and on your own terms. Don't wait for your doctor to start the conversation. Start the discussion on your own with family and friends. Here are four questions that can help start the process. What kinds of things are most important to you? What concerns do you have about getting sick or needing medical care? If you were very sick, are there any specific medical treatments that might be too much for you? And finally, what are your spiritual, philosophical, religious, or cultural beliefs that would influence your medical decisions? Considering these questions is only the beginning. These reflections are not a one-time event, but a process that you should return to over time. After you've thought about your values and wishes, it's important to share your information with your loved ones. Holidays are a good time to start having these discussions with the people you would want to be around if you became very sick. Pick a calm and quiet place to talk. The talk doesn't have to have a certain structure. Let it just happen. And you don't need to establish everything with one conversation. After the conversation, I often tell my patients to use their cell phone or tablet to film themselves telling their loved ones what is most important in their lives regarding medical care. They can then send the video to them. And if you are ready, complete the appropriate legal paperwork. Now you're ready to complete the last step, talking with your healthcare team. Talking with your doctor is vital, since he or she will know your medical condition best and will be able to help translate your preferences into an actionable medical plan. There are three general approaches to medical care for people who are very sick. They are life prolonging care, limited medical care, and comfort care. The first approach is life prolonging care. With this option, the focus is to lengthen life. This includes all medical care that is available in the hospital, like CPR, breathing machines, and treatments in the ICU. For healthy people, CPR has a good chance of success and has improved over time. However, for people with an advanced illness, CPR's overall effectiveness is not high. It's important to ask your doctor what the chances are that CPR will work in someone like you. Sometimes, people decide to try life-prolonging interventions for a short period of time, and if the interventions are not successful, they move to the next option, limited medical care. With limited medical care, the focus is to take care of treatable problems. People who choose this approach want medical care that will help restore their health. My father received limited medical care. He had IV medications with careful monitoring. But he did not want any life-prolonging interventions like CPR and breathing machines. He chose to avoid these procedures even though he might have died without them. The third approach is comfort care. With comfort care, the main goal is to be comfortable. Treatments are only used if they help make people feel better and improve their quality of life. People who choose this approach are usually treated at home, in hospice, or sometimes in a nursing home. Talk to your doctor and your loved ones. If you let them know your choices, they can help make sure that you are at the center of and in control of your care. Now, we're all friends here tonight, and friends are honest with each other, and I want you to be honest with me. Are all of our clinicians having honest conversations like that with patients who have an advanced serious illness here in the Bay Area or across the country? Are all of our providers speaking at a pace that a patient who is vomiting in the emergency room can actually understand what they're being asked? Or are they speaking like this, which is actually my baseline because I'm from New York City and I speak really darn fast? Are all of our doctors speaking at a literacy level of fourth or fifth grade so that a patient for whom English is not their primary language, that they could actually understand them? No. If I was up here and I said, are all of your surgeons operating on the correct side of the body? If anybody said no, we would have the newspapers here, and that hospital would be shut down. But when all of us agree that our doctors are not asking questions and offering people their options for care at the end of life, we all freely acknowledge it. No more. Patients and families need to take back healthcare. Healthcare today is about me, the doctor. It's not about you. And the new phrase of the day is patient-centered care. Think about that. Is our healthcare system today truly patient-centered? I don't think so. And let me be honest with you, because this is a confession of sorts for me. I'm a hospitalist. I see 22 patients who are pretty darn sick in my hospital when I'm on service. Do you think I have conversations like that? I am rushed. I have maybe 12 minutes to have this conversation or to see my patient. I'm running from room to room. I'm human. Sometimes I forget. Well, what a great idea to have a video to standardize the conversation so that everybody can know the questions and their options for medical care. Is it possible? Is that a potential future for all of us? I think so. But let's go to our patients. Remember the two groups? Half of the group had a verbal discussion, the other half had a verbal discussion plus the video. What do you think people wanted in the verbal arm? In yellow is life-prolonging care, blue is limited care, green is comfort care. Now remember, these are all patients with advanced terminal cancer, only had a few months to live. Just call out some numbers. What do people think, the group that just had a conversation, what do you think they wanted for life-prolonging care? What percentage? 60, 70, 30. All right. What about the middle group, the blue group? What do you think? 50. What about the green, comfort care? What do you think? 10. Well, this is what we found. About 26% wanted life-prolonging care, 52% in blue wanted limited care, and 22% in green wanted comfort care. I'll be honest, I wasn't surprised at this. I admit these patients to the hospital routinely. About a quarter of patients with an advanced terminal illness want it all. About a quarter want to focus on comfort and quality of life. Then half of people are still somewhere in between. What about the group that had the conversation but also saw a video which told them these are the questions you need to ask yourself and these are your options? What do you think they chose? What do you think they wanted in terms of life-prolonging care? 10. What about limited care? 25. And comfort care? Not a single person wanted life-prolonging care. The overwhelming majority wanted comfort care. And I'm not even showing you all the variables. People were more informed. People were more certain. People were more likely to have a conversation with their providers. All the good stuff that we want in healthcare. Just with a short video that primed people, that activated them, that told them, that wasn't reliant on the healthcare system. If we're going to be reliant on doctors to do everything, guess what? Nothing ain't going to change. People need to take this back. Look, all of us in America right now, doctors are still trying to learn how to do this. And you see what's under the verbal arm. About two-thirds of Americans are still dying in our hospitals. But what's possible? What could the future be? What do we see under the video arm? Most people dying at home. Looking at their loved one's face, not the face of a stranger. I am a stranger to most of my patients. Look, back home in Brooklyn, if you did something unto my body against my will, that's called assault and battery. In healthcare, it's the standard of care. I really mean that. Now, I've been doing this for about a decade, and we've had over 3,000 patients. And I'm just going to quickly show you what we do and what we see. When we ask older people about dementia, when they have a conversation, focus on the green, 68% want comfort care. But when they actually see dementia, 86% want comfort care in green. When we go to outpatient practices and we talk to people, 72% in green want comfort care. But when they actually see what we're talking about, 91%. When we go to nursing homes, where nobody talks about this. When people have a conversation, 57% in green want comfort care, but when they actually see what's involved, 80%. When we go to the intensive care units, this time we're not talking to the patients. They have a tube shoved down their throat. We're talking to the sons and daughters and their partners. 78% want CPR attempted in red, but when the families actually see it with a video, 40%. What's possible? And just to give you a sense of the scope of this, now we are doing studies all across the country. Our largest study is looking at 600 nursing homes, where half of the nursing homes get just whatever's offered, usual care, and the other half of nursing homes use videos to prioritize having the conversation, and that study is 100,000 patients. What's possible? Now, I started this work about a decade ago. Dr. Lenny Lopez, who is now chair of hospitalist medicine at the VA here, is one of my co-investigators, and he, along with my wife, looked at me when we got our first big publication. And they told me, you know, Angelo, this is great. You know, we're all co-authors. We all got a nice publication. You're going to get your tenure at Harvard. But what's that really going to do? How is it going to help people like our parents who are immigrants? We're the kids of immigrants. And so what the three of us decided to do was, why don't we try to transform healthcare? And so we created a nonprofit foundation that has partnered with over 500 places across the country, where now this is the new standard of care to have the conversation, to empower patients and families with videos so that people are at the center of care, not doctors. And it's a lot of hard work, and wonderful foundations in the Bay Area, like the Stupski Foundation, the Moore Foundation, have supported our work. But you know, the truth is, if we just wait until people are in the hospital, it's too late. It's like putting a Band-Aid on a gushing carotid artery. We really need to get this way upstream, outside of the hospital. And so about 3 years ago, I got a telephone call from a state that said, Angelo, we want you to make the conversation the new normal for our entire state. And that is the state of Hawaii, where today, every single hospital, every nursing home, all the providers in the state, all 1.4 million residents of the state use our videos to be the new standard of care, where people are not only talking about this in the hospital, but they're talking about it at church, at synagogue, at temple. They're talking about it on television, on the radio, because it's the new normal. Now, how many of you have been to Hawaii? Great. Of course, it's the West Coast. Well, I'm a poor kid from Brooklyn. I had never been to Hawaii. Well, it's been 35 trips later in 3 years. And one thing I've realized is Hawaii ain't Boston. And I thought New York was diverse, but Hawaii is more diverse. But a video of me ain't gonna speak to the people of Hawaii. So what we did is we decided to refilm all the videos using the chair of medicine at the University of Hawaii, who I think you'll agree looks a lot more Hawaiian than I do.
I'd like to talk to you about decisions you might have.
And although Dr. Lopez and I created the videos, an entire suite of videos in Spanish, there aren't many Latinos in Hawaii. But there sure are a lot of Asians. So working with the local community, we created a whole series of Chinese, Cantonese, and Mandarin videos. But why stop there? We created videos in the Filipino languages, Tagalog and Ilocano, Japanese, Korean, Vietnamese. But when we looked at the inequities in the healthcare system, it really was minority populations that were most affected. So we created the first ever Samoan video and Marshallese or Chuckie's video. And what we try to do is try to help people in their cultural milieu, in the language that they understand end-of-life decisions, to empower them to know the questions they need to ask, but to understand their options. And you know what the remarkable thing is? In the first 18 months, in 42,000 lives, the number of people who had documented what they wanted increased by 42%. When we looked at hospice services, had increased by 25%. But be careful what you ask for. If we had a healthcare system that was saner and didn't pour its money into ICUs and poured its money into hospices, we'd have a very different healthcare system. It's really hard to get hospice in Hawaii, largely due to people telling us what they want. Think about it. What's possible here in the Bay Area? What's possible across this country? But you know, I've shown you a lot of data. And as Dr. Zitter knows, I'm not a data guy. I hate data sometimes. So what I wanted to end with tonight is the way I began tonight, which is with a story. And I'm actually going to switch microphones to this one. Wonderful, thank you. And I'd like to end, I'd like to end this evening. As you can, well, maybe you couldn't tell, but I'm kind of passionate about this. But I need you to understand why I have sacrificed, why Dr. Lopez and my wife have sacrificed our professional and personal careers to try to transform healthcare. And I think after you hear this story, you'll understand why. But I think the more salient question for you is, was this patient your father? Taras Skripchenko was a living part of American history. As I later found out, Taras was an ethnic Ukrainian. He was one of the lucky few who escaped the chaos that took over during the months before World War II. Taras wanted to start over, to rewrite the opening chapters of his life. At 18, he found a new home in a Ukrainian enclave in one of the mining towns of Appalachia and quickly found labor in the coal mines. For years, he led a life of unremitting physical toil, working 12-hour shifts 6 days a week. Unfortunately for Taras, a lot of the detritus from smashing coal dug its way deep into the lining of his lungs. It would also plant the creeping cancer that would devastate him decades later. This once hulking mine worker had dwindled to a mere whisper of his former muscular self. This frail, bed-bound 78-year-old with inoperable lung cancer was admitted to my medical service during my first year of residency. Slowly suffocating to death, he experienced both transient moments of hallucinatory joy and unconscious yet peaceful somnolence on the oncology ward. Taras was too confused to have a lucid conversation, so his medical plan was the default approach for all patients. Do everything. Despite my efforts to come up with a plan for Taras, I knew that his cancer surely had a plan of its own. Doctors can fool themselves into thinking that they are in charge, even though disease and pathology are in the driver's seat. Frequently, we are only along for the ride. Taras was dying. I knew it and the nurses knew it. But as far as the medical team was concerned, Taras was a full code. We were going to perform CPR if his heart should stop beating. Exhausted from a long day, I paged the overnight resident to meet me in the cafeteria to review my list of patients. The overnight doctor was a senior resident named Edward. And I was glad an experienced resident was on call that night because Taras was going to need him. He's a Ukrainian gentleman who worked in the coal mines of Appalachia. About 8 months ago, he began having a cough. His primary care doctor ordered a chest x-ray. "Stop right there," Edward said. "Start again. Start with initials. And then in one line, give me the pertinent info. Less is more. I have 30 other patients to cover tonight." When a resident is responsible for 30 patients at night, too many personal details can muddle one's thinking. T.S. is a 78-year-old male patient with metastatic lung cancer who presented with shortness of breath, I said. "He's really sick." Modern medicine can be dehumanizing, and the first step in that process is to remove all the individualized details, to obliterate personhood and replace it with patienthood. "Code blue, code blue!" Edward and I sprinted towards the oncology ward, racing through the obstacle course of stretchers and patients. We finally arrived at Dadas's room. I was always taught to hope for the best, but prepare for the worst before walking into a patient's room. But it's not always clear how to define the worst at times. The gathered nurses who had ordered the code blue had already started CPR. I clumsily jammed my hands into a pair of rubber gloves and joined the ritual, which is far more demanding and brutal than what is portrayed on television. Edward stood at the foot of the bed. I searched for a pulse on Thaddeus's neck. Any fat had melted away long ago, and all I could feel was cartilage and windpipe. Shockingly, I found a pulse. Thaddeus was stabilized. He was connected to a breathing machine, and he had a normal rhythm. The team had saved the patient, and now it was time to transfer him to the ICU. We squeezed into the narrow elevator as the doors closed. I kept my hand on Dadas' carotid artery, making sure he still had a pulse, until I realized he no longer had one. Dadas was almost dead. There was no space alongside the gurney, so I jumped on, straddled him, and started performing chest compressions. In all likelihood, the cancer had spread to the thin sac surrounding his heart, allowing blood and fluid to seep in and surround the vigorously pumping heart muscle. To get the heart beating again, a doctor must emergently stick a large needle into the patient's chest. We needed to move fast. "Do you feel comfortable doing this?" Edward asked me. I told him that I had performed the procedure on a cadaver in anatomy class, but had only seen one on a patient. "See one, do one, teach one. Here's your chance on a warm body," he rejoined. I descended from the gurney. Edward handed me a large syringe. My hands were shaking, not surprisingly, since I was about to blindly poke around a man's heart. You don't know how deep to slide the needle into the body in order to draw out the fluid. Every body is different. Some are fatter than others, and some are more muscular than fat. I pierced his skin, no luck. Tried again and again and again. By the fourth time, I gave up. Residents are usually allowed 3 strikes before being asked to stop. Edward gave me a 4th, since this was my patient. I probably should have stopped after the 3rd. Dadas' ribcage had become a pincushion from all my attempts. As soon as we entered the ICU, Edward filled in the medical team, and they used an ultrasound machine to remove the liquid surrounding his heart. Dadas' once flailing heart could beat again. He had a pulse. Dadas' care was now being managed by the ICU team, so Edward and I headed back to the cafeteria to grab some coffee. After every code blue, the team is expected to review what's transpired. It's a ritualized moment to grapple with the trauma surrounding a full-on code. Debriefings are always difficult moments as each of us dials down the rapid pace of a code blue to digest the events that have just transpired. We sat quietly for a few minutes. "We just completed a by-the-book code, but I wonder if we did the right thing," I said, needing to tell Edward what was on my mind. Perhaps it was because I was a young doctor and I had not yet been numbed to the brutal experience of caring for hundreds of patients. "We did exactly what we were taught to do. Everything was by the book. Look, this is the system. We have a job to do," Edward said. I knew something was not right. "I can't believe we just did all that to a man who has one foot in the grave." I pushed, not mincing my words. "Would you have wanted any of this? Would he have wanted any of this? Would you do this to your dad? Something is wrong with a system that puts terminal cancer patients through torture." Edward put a hand on my shoulder. "It's going to be all right. You're still new at this. You'll get used to it. Get some sleep and page me tomorrow." Get used to it? Is one supposed to get used to this? Over the next 2 days, Edward and I visited Dadas every few hours in the ICU. He was no longer our patient, but we could not let go of him either. By the following morning, he had a tube or catheter in almost every part of his body, a grand total of 8 plastic intrusions. Dadas was fixed. Doctors like to tackle problems and treat them, and it is truly amazing what modern medicine has achieved. The tougher issue, however, is when to recognize that small fixes do not change the larger picture. To recognize that fixing specific problems may not fix the whole patient. This is medicine's version of not seeing the forest for the trees. Doctors always search for the next fix, but we need to know when to use or not to use our growing toolkit of fixes. Dadas' heart had stopped 3 more times, and miraculously, the ICU team had brought him back each time. But not surprisingly, a man in the late stages of terminal cancer succumbed to his disease. Whatever the next new fix is, nature eventually takes her inexorable course. Dadas died 48 hours after that initial code blue. Americans receive some of the best healthcare money can buy. They also experience some of the worst deaths in the developed world. The primary reason we experience such horrible deaths is doctors' failure to openly discuss medical care with seriously ill patients. Dada Skripchenko died 15 years ago. I have since witnessed hundreds of deaths. But his, which I experienced during the formative years of medical residency, haunted me for the first decade of my life as a young physician. So too did that conversation with Edward as I struggled to make sense of the drama that had just unfolded in front of me. Today, I'm a full-fledged medical doctor, a senior physician, and teacher of others. Yet, I still think about Taras each time I meet a new patient, a new beginning, a clean slate, but also a potential TS. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's time for me to remind you that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Mark Zitter, chair of the Zetima Project and CEO of Zitter Health Insights. And our guest tonight is Dr. Angelo Volandes of Harvard Medical School, author of The Conversation, A Revolutionary Plan for End-of-Life Care. We're going to have these comment cards passed out if they have not already been. Appreciate that. So you can ask some questions. And I'll ask the first one while we're getting the cards passed out. Thank you. So how can individuals who don't live in Hawaii or aren't part of the health systems you're working with have access to the videos? You mentioned the website. Does that give them sufficient or full access for their purposes?
Right. So am I on? There we go.
Yeah.
So what we've done is made freely available, in addition to the video that you saw, 8 other videos in multiple languages, as well as checklists in 20 languages for people to help and empower themselves. Those videos are at acpdecisions.org. They're freely available. Go to the patient resources page, acpdecisions.org. Because our goal is to transform healthcare, not in just Hawaii, not in the 500 places that we have partnered with, but really across the country. And the only way that's going to happen is if you, people, not patients, people, actually take healthcare back and empower yourselves.
Great, thanks. Now, I know originally you started showing people the ICU and showing these videos to teach them about things they weren't aware of, and you made a lot of videos. I'm wondering if in all the exploration that you've done, even though you're a physician, did you see something, did you learn something new that surprised you about the healthcare system?
Yeah. where to begin with that question? The healthcare system's a funny thing. It's hard to change doctors' bad habits. And I think it's the MDeity degree. You get the degree and you think you know everything perfectly. And so what I found is that you could have the best intentions, but you have to not just rely on doctors. The truth is, this conversation is not just the purview of doctors. Why should it be? There's nothing special about asking someone what's important to them. You don't need to have gone to medical school for 4 years. And so the one thing I've learned is that we need to expand this conversation. We need to get nurses. We need to get social workers, chaplains. I even have pharmacists, trained lay people. I even bring the clergy on. I'm like, we're talking about theology here, values, and what's existentially important to you. That's not my purview. So the more I learn about how the healthcare system works, the more I realize that this is a far bigger issue than what's happening in our hospitals. This should happen at a community level, which is why I love this Commonwealth Club event, because this is about you. This is about you and the community and engaging in these conversations.
Great, thanks. Those of you who have questions, do raise your hand and we'll be giving you a question card.
Thank you.
As you know, Angela, my background is business, not clinical. And, I co-founded a company that does telephone counseling for patients at end of life. That business made sense as a business because, as you well know, we found, and it's been found many other places, that when patients, as you see, are sufficiently educated and informed without giving them any advice, they very often choose a less intensive form of care, right? Less expensive form of care. So my question is, I know that you're primarily funded by states and foundations and so forth. Is there a business model that might accelerate the uptake of the videos, because this is actually one of the rare cases in healthcare where we can actually give people better care that they like better and save money at the same time?
So this is the remarkable thing about, this is one of the few sweet spots in medicine where doing the right thing by the patient and actually listening to them and improving the general health of the community by all of us talking about this actually makes all of us better stewards of our limited resources. That's amazing. It's one of the few times in healthcare where that is the case. And so I tell this to people all the time. We have to switch from a healthcare system where we're paying $10,000 a day for an ICU bed in my hospital, 10 grand. And yet my hospice nurse gets 120 bucks per day for busting her butt to get to that patient's house, to give them medication, make sure they're not in pain, to wipe them, help them. That is crazy. We need to change a healthcare system where we spend $10,000 a day to make sure people get the home care that they need, not just a nurse for 1 hour, not just a doc for 1 hour for the week, but for around-the-clock service. Why is it? Why don't we have that? It's our right. It's our money. We need to change the paradigm. I'm hopeful.
Great.
Well,
great.
I was hopeful until November
8th. I won't get into that right now. We've got a lot of great questions.
No comment.
We have a lot of great questions. We've just a couple minutes left, but we'll see how many we can get through. And here's a key one that I've heard from a few people. How much of the problem around not having the conversation is due to a for-profit medical system?
Yeah, so that's my whole point, is I'm paid to do things to your body. I'm not paid to sit down and talk with you. You need to know that. That changed. CMS, Centers for Medicare and Services, started this year where we can actually get paid for sitting down and talking to you. And the what's required of us is very, very little. Just a simple one-liner in our notes. And you get paid 100 bucks. All right, you might say, 100 bucks. But that's something. The sad thing is most doctors still aren't using that. That's a problem. And I blame Medicare. How could you all of a sudden have a code to get paid, but you don't make sure these doctors actually know how to talk to patients? They were never trained. Could you imagine if we had a new cardiothoracic procedure where cardiothoracic surgeons were reimbursed and Medicare didn't certify that they could do the procedure? Having the conversation is one of the hardest procedures you could possibly do in medicine, and yet we treat it like, oh, that's the soft stuff. We don't train doctors to do that. Baloney. It's a huge problem in our healthcare system. Mm-hmm. I'll be much shorter and faster.
That's okay. You had a couple questions about the videos themselves. The ones that link together are, in the data you showed about the different choices people make after watching a video, was that just after one video that was showed? And which video did you show to the research group? And what different diagnoses do you have represented
right.
in the
video? Right. So we have over 200 videos in 20 languages. And it's really due to foundations that support the work that we do. For example, the Moore Foundation and the Stupski Foundation funded our newest videos, which are in Navajo. Navajo. I mean, there is no business case to make a Navajo video, okay, folks? There aren't enough people who speak the language to make a business case. But that's where you look towards private foundations to do the right thing. I mean, that's why we're a nonprofit. I don't have a quarterly report to do. I have people to help. And the other video that the foundations helped was a neonatal ICU video. So pediatrics, that's where we're going, because those are the toughest questions. And people, we all need help when we make those sort of decisions. So it's about 200 videos, nearly 20 languages. And we do our best to make sure it's impartial and fair. We're not trying to nudge, to use that Sunstein Thaler art expression. We're really trying to empower people.
had a couple questions about how people make different decisions often when they're healthy than when they're sick.
Yeah.
And how do you deal with that? They have the conversation early on. And similarly, if you have, say, an elderly, demented patient in a skilled nursing facility who's, you know, can't even make, has an advanced directive from years ago, is it still current? How
do you Those are tough questions in just a few seconds. So let's first go, well, let me just take the nursing home question, because advanced Alzheimer's disease, that's the toughest one, right? The patient in front of us, the person in front of us can no longer make decisions. And so what we have trying to do is to have videos to show when people are just diagnosed, when they still can make decisions. We actually have a video to show them this is the early stage, this is the middle stage or moderate stage, and this is what the advanced stages look like. And this way, people, your decisions will change over time, but we're not just showing that to patients, we're showing them to their sons and daughters. And just to give you a sense of, I know I'm near Silicon Valley, this is what 2.0 of all this work will look like. What we're doing now is taking patients, and again, this is really early stage work, we're taking people and bringing them to the office, the clinic, way early, years before they're ever in the ICU. We sit down with them, we'll Skype in their loved one, the daughter from California, which I believe here is the daughter from New York. And what we'll do is we'll all sit down, have a conversation, we'll watch a video, but then using that iPhone or tablet or iCamera on the desktop computer, we will record what the patient says they want, what's important to them. And then we will get that short QuickTime video and email it to all the sons and daughters, all the kids, all the doctors, the thousands of specialists in New York or Boston or San Francisco, but also we'll email that video to the electronic medical record. This way, your EMR, the hospital, uploads that video. Now think about what's possible. I'm the ER doctor. You come into my ER. I don't know you. I look at your record in the computer. I was like, oh, medicine, allergy. Wait a minute, there's a video. Let me check it out. I see you. I hear you. I see a face. It's very different than some stupid form that I don't know if you even understood what the form said. Now I call that daughter in New York who's going to help me make this decision, and instead of asking her, what did Mom want? Did you actually talk? Did you even see her this Thanksgiving? It's, Mom actually left us a video. Let me send you the link. Take a look at the video, and then let's work together to make sure that we can honor and respect Mom. That's 2.0. That's what we try to do, is just leverage technology. You are in Silicon Valley. Let's leverage technology to help us make sure you get the care that you want at the time you want.
Great. Some terrific things. We have more questions, but we don't have more time. So I'd like to thank Dr. Angel Velandez of Harvard Medical School for his comments. Thank the audience here in San Francisco, as well as those on the radio and podcast. I'm Mark Zitter, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Thank you.